Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And I did ride out with Scott. The wife and I rode out. They brought about 30 or 40 guys from up in the D.C. area, a few girls, but they were outnumbered heavily. Anyway, that's a whole different story. But we packed into a minivan, and God knows I felt like a sardine when we got down here. That was something else, but we had a great time, really great time. It's good to be here. Now, my job is to dumb it down. We've been on an intellectual journey here this weekend, and it's been an excellent weekend. All the speakers are good friends, and I don't like that word speakers. We're not speakers, for God's sakes. If we're speakers, we get in the wrong orbit. We're storytellers. That's what we are. And what we do is tell our stories. And that's what I'm going to do this morning. And it is great to be back in the beautiful downtown Prim. And I just miss Whiskey Pete. What a marvelous, marvelous spiritual experience to go to Whiskey Pete's. Even more marvelous to get out of Whiskey Pete's. Is that my water, Scott? I certainly drink more than that. But I got to have some more. Now, somebody have mercy and give me enough water to drown. Bob,
you are my hero, darling.
Appreciate it. Bob knows how this feels. He just got through. By the way, Scott loves me so much, he ripped me off for a year. I'll be 54 years in February of this coming, so it's right around the corner, if I make it. But that was pretty close for somebody who lives in Washington, D.C. They usually get the prices a little out of whack. So, well, it is my job to dumb it down a little bit because you're getting ready to go back in the world. And if you've driven in Las Vegas traffic downtown, you know that you need to be grounded very thoroughly and don't be up in some stratosphere above thinking that the whole world's blissful and everybody lovey-poo. Be ready when you get back into the city because they're going to be just like they were when you left. So that's my job. My specialty in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was drinking too. I was always a great guy for ending parties. And I could break up parties no matter how good they were. So that's my job here, to break this one up. So I'll get started. Now I'm going to talk about, just like old people do, I'm going to talk about the old days and talk about the 12th step, but I'm going to sneak up on it. And, you know, 12 steps is having that spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. Try to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And you've heard some great stuff. You heard my buddy last night, Cliff, doing just an outstanding job on talking about he was really talking about my step. It was a great rehearsal. And but really, really good stuff. My buddy Bill, I agreed with almost everything he said, except I had one little different perspective. He said it right. He said, we do some things better now than we did in the old days. And that's very true. But we also do some things far worse now than we did in the old days. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, contrast that a little bit, as we go along. I'm a guy now, I don't have any real expertise on that stuff, but I've got a lot of experience on it. I'm a guy, I'm not going to tell too much, very much of my story, really, but I really do want to talk about it, us and our fellowship and where we are and who we are and that kind of thing. Amazing thing, when I came in AA, I didn't know a soul. And I swear to God, there's hardly any place on the planet I can go now and not know somebody who'll get mad if I don't get in touch with them. And coming here, I know at least 3/4 of this group. About 3/4 of this group could tell my story. And so if I happen to fall out, just whoever wants to, come on up and finish it. And you probably do it better than me. But I'm a guy, and I'm just going to condense it real tight. I was a guy that started drinking early on. I wasn't an instant alcoholic, but I was a troubled guy who was set up as a real, real ripe candidate for alcoholism. Booze did something important for me. I loved it from day one. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. And I drank like a pig. And just took off and got into lots of trouble in lots of places and you name it, and I've probably done it. I went in the military, got thrown out when I was 20 years old. My discharge papers said, unfit for military service, alcoholism. And I'm 20 years old. That had about as much impact on me as the next fallen star. Yet nothing. Didn't mean a thing. And so, when I hit the street, and just picked up exactly where I didn't leave off. I just happened to move, change locations. And proved very much that you can work hard and go downhill. And as I worked hard once in a while, I had a boss one time told me that I was the best employee he ever had 3 days a week. And the other two, I'm a missing in action guy. And so I really just knew how to screw stuff up big time. I'll just frame this in this little way of putting it. You know, that in the book we use some terms to describe that fog that prohibits us from seeing what's happening. And you know, in the real world, in society, people use the term denial for not being able to face up to things that are in the past. We don't use that in the book. What we use are a couple of words that are synonymous in a way, but a little more telling when it comes to alcoholism. Use the word delusion, an inability to see reality, an inability to differentiate the true from the false. That certainly characterizes what my drinking was about. In other words, we use an illusion, an inability to see the world as it is. And as I'm going through my paces and absolutely proving how quickly you can destroy a life and others along with it, in 8 short years, I started serious drinking at 16, had what I hoped and prayed was my last drink when I was 24. And in the course of it, absolutely devastated my life and unfortunately that of others as well. And the thing where those words, illusion and delusion, come in is that as I was doing that, I could not see the reality of what was happening to me. And as a guy in his late teens and early 20s, I can remember very well what it was like to look in a mirror and want to throw up at what I saw. To take a look in there and just say to myself, my God, man, why don't you just hang it up? And I'm talking late teens and early 20s. I remember that. But even then, the illusion and delusion was strong enough that I simply could not get hold of it. Everybody who ever captured me, and that was a lot of people, they diagnosed me as alcoholic. They used a lot of different terms, but that's what it all boiled down to. None of it had any meaning. I never believed any of it. And so I just crashed on through life. Wound up, I hope there's some Michigan people here because they need a lot of help. I wound up in the state of Michigan. That's rough enough. But I wound up in a place called Flint, one of Roger Moore's favorite places on the planet. He's written 2 books about how much he loves it. I wound up there. You got to be drunk to wind up in Flint. I do believe you got to be drunker to stay there, and I stayed there, and that's where I really met my Waterloo. Went to work for Buick. They knew I was employed, but if they looked at my work, they wouldn't have thought I was working for them. They would have thought I was working for Ford. Helped them produce some real lemons in there, I'm sure, and got fired and. And then just sort of drifted down the chain. And what my life became was just a series of hitting the wall, starting over. Hitting the wall, starting over. And every time I hit the wall, started over, what I didn't recognize is that I would ratchet down another notch. And right by the time I was 24 years old, I was living a way of life that I didn't even know existed. And by the time I got down to the end of it, it seemed normal. It seemed normal. The book refers to that, where that abnormal life seemed the only normal life. And it was a very, very, very reasonable way for me to live. And so I did and continued with it. I used to rather morbidly predict, Bob, can I emulate your behavior and get out of this thing? I need permission from my elders to do that. Can I trust you? Well, he's a biker, for God's sakes. What do you expect? You got to check him out. I'm not a biker, but I ride a motorcycle a little bit. And, we got an image, you know. I throw this in. I no extra charge for this either. But I rode over one day to do some lab work at the hospital. Somebody pulled up space. I pulled in, and there was a lady's purse sitting there. And so I got off as a good Samaritan and grabbed the purse. Only now I don't run with it. As I took it in, and a fellow came by that had been parked in that space, and he saw me sitting over there on the motorcycle. And he came over and said, "Did you see a purse?" I said, "Yeah, I saw a purse. Can we get it?" I said, "Yeah, go in there to that desk. They got it. They're waiting for you." And he said, "Man, you never know how much I appreciate that. We got a lot of stuff in there." I said, "Well, you don't need to thank me. Just the next time you see somebody talk about what thugs and idiots bikers are, you tell them about this. Don't tell them about that. Tell them about this." So I made a bid for us, you know. So that's why I'm trusting you with my coat. I got a lot of stuff in there, too. You watch him. But anyway, that's what I did. And in that city, wound up just hustling. And yeah, I'm not a criminal. I never have been. I've never committed a predatory, deliberate crime in my life. Now, I've been to jail a lot of times, but it's always for drunk and. Fill in the blank. If you can do it drunk, I've done it drunk and been locked up for it. And so I've been locked up a lot of times. I have no clue how many. I like to think it's exactly the right number of times. Because I haven't been to jail since. And so I hope it's the right number of times. And just as we went, you wound up selling my blood in that city. $5 a throw. I don't know what it goes for now, but I know some people are selling it. There's no question about that. And they probably get a lot more than $5 a throw. I would have let them pump me dry had they not had controls on that sort of thing. I don't know how they controlled it, but anyway, they did. So that's how I wound up. And, you know, I knew I was not on a roll. But back then, unlike today, there were not commercials. Well, I didn't watch television much anyway. But I'd never heard of anybody helping a drunk. That was a totally foreign language. In the military, they were nice to me before they gave me an undesirable discharge. They were nice and said, "Man, you ought to straighten up. You could do well if you weren't such a drunk." But I'd never heard anybody talk about helping a drunk. That was a foreign language. So it never occurred. And then I wound up, as many of you know, I wound up doing the kind of things I think every alcoholic in the world fears doing. Thank God most don't. But I wound up being responsible for two young people dying because their only mistake was trying to cross the street where I was trying to drive. And I'm blind, drunk, blacked out, and accident occurred, and I was directly responsible for the deaths of two young people. Woke up in jail the next morning and didn't even know that there'd been an accident. Didn't know what I was in there for. One of the guys in there told me what I was charged with. Because mind is a strange thing. You know, Bob talked a lot about what a mind will do. And a mind's a strange thing. It won't accept what it can't handle. And that was more than I could handle. You know, I'm not some kind of a guy that's cold-blooded or unmindful of human life. But that was more news than I could handle. And I just refused to believe it, pushed it away, and then gradually accepted the truth. I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And my notion then was I just wanted to disappear. I just wanted to be gone. And it didn't matter where. Didn't want to get out of jail. But for some reason, some policeman there took it on himself to look up records and contact my folks in North Carolina. And my family do what families of alcoholics often do. And that's the totally unreasonable thing of trying to help a drunk who's in that spiral. And so my family made a trip from North Carolina to Michigan that they couldn't afford. Got an attorney that they couldn't afford to help me deal with a crime that I didn't even want to deal with. I just wanted to be gone. But I didn't know how to tell them. I didn't know how to tell them I was afraid to get out of jail. I didn't know how to tell them that I couldn't stand to look anybody in the eye. And so they did. And was released on bond and then from the 18th of July till the 19th of November of 56, of which was the date of my last drink. It, not my recovery, but it was the date of my last drink. Not drinking and recovery are two totally different things. And so when that's what happened. I just stayed blind drunk. And then on the 19th, I went to court, finished a bottle of gin, wasn't quite that much. Finished it off, went to court, knew I wouldn't be back. I knew it was a one-way trip. And I listened to the testimony as if I were on the jury, because it was all new to me. And when it got through, I would have voted guilty, which is exactly what the jury did. And I was sentenced to a maximum of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. And I, you know, while I'd been in jails and stockades and pea farms and all kinds of stuff where you could find drunks lightweight, I'd never had even consciously seen a prison. I'm sure I drove by them, but it just didn't register. And then they passed that sentence, and I had an instinctive reaction of fear. I guess it's a very normal thing, an instinctive reaction of fear. But the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. Wouldn't be any more. I'm not talking about happy ending or there'll be help there, any of that stuff. It was done. It was flat done. Next day, walked into that institution, and thank God, walked into a real group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you know, it, sometimes we strain into the gnat on that with trying to fine-tune the difference between them. You know, if you take a look in our literature, the definition of group is about as generous as it could possibly be. It couldn't be more generous. Two or more alcoholics gathered together for the purpose of recovery may call themselves an AA group, provided they have no other affiliation. That means if you and I wanted to go out here in this parking lot and cite, must be a biker, anonymous AA group, we could do that. There's absolutely no prohibition. We could do it. And so there's no definition of when does it quit being a meeting and start to become a group. That's a very subjective decision, because there is no definition in our fellowship. But I think there's an important distinction, and that's what I really want to kind of focus on in terms of the 12-step. There's a lot of ways to do 12-step work, and I want to bounce around in as many of those neighborhoods as I can get. And a lot of y'all told me you're going to have to leave, and so am I. But I'm going to try to be done by the time you are. But I walked into a group, a real group, recovery group at the State Penitentiary of Jackson, Michigan. It'll always be my home group. I just don't want to be a regular member. I go back once in a while to say hello to the guys that are there and make sure I'm not there. And it's a great, great experience every time I do that. But when I walked into that, I'm a dead man walking. I was absolutely so grief-stricken and deeply, deeply ashamed of my entire life, and particularly culminated with two young folks being dead because of me. And I was almost comatose in a way when I walked in there. I didn't communicate with anybody, I didn't greet anybody, and I just walked in. I was a dead man walking, literally. And went through the intake process. A guy did one of those family history things, you know, of who you are, what you've done, all that kind of stuff. And he had my record, you know, and so I've never done a deliberate crime. Everything I have ever done is drunk and. And that's what I had. He held, this guy that interviewed me, did the social history, held up my record. It was about that thick. Everything in there was drunk and. And when he looked at that, he reviewed it, and he said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." I said, "Yeah, that's kind of a no-brainer." And he said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, it wasn't like we unfortunately do today, where we start mandating and dictating and chain hackling to people, how we drag them into AA now. It was a lot different. He just made a friendly suggestion. He said, "You've had a lot of trouble with booze. We've got an AA group. You ought to go." I didn't know what he was talking about. I'd never heard of anything like that. When he said that, he might as well have said, "We've got a ballet corps here, and you might ought to join that." Would have meant just as much. He said, "But I don't know what he was talking about." And so I left, Yeah, with no real impact. There was no conversation. I didn't ask any questions. I already knew more than I wanted to anyway. And so I didn't ask anything. So I walked out, went to my cell and did what I was trying to do. And that was find some way to live without thinking. And I spent my entire life in the period that I was in there before AA doing my best to not think. And there are a lot of ways to do it, but you can't shut it off entirely. And so that's what I was doing. And after a couple of weeks, something like that, he sent me a little note, said, you can go to your first AA meeting. I hadn't said I wanted to go to one. But it was just, I guess, an assumption of his. He sent me that note, said, you go. Well, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know if you had to have a ticket like to a football game. Had no clue. And didn't ask any questions because I wasn't talking to anybody. And that day came, and when they announced AA, I got up, and this was before they had electronic cells. They had that old sliding door. You know, they'd throw the lock, and I'd slide the door. If you wanted to go to AA, step out. So I did. They had no clue where I'm going. But that's the value of being totally beat. You know, I think the most beautiful word in the language of recovery is surrender, not knowledge, surrender. Where I give up, and I know at the depth of my soul, I am beat. I am absolutely beat. And that's where I was. I couldn't even muster resistance. And I just responded like the Pavlov dog. Opened the door and I stepped out. I picked up, I guess, from other guys' just conversation that it sounded to me like it was going to be some kind of a religious frenzy of some sort. And I was braced for that because I'd gotten introduced to that as a child and swore if I ever got big enough, I'd get out of that and wouldn't go back. And I didn't go back until I was sober 11 years before I ever went into a church. I meant that. I was deeply, deeply torn about that whole matter of spiritual life or religion or anything like that. And so I was sure that's what it's going to be. Walked in, and the first thing they did was pray. That serenity prayer that we opened with here today. Did that prayer. Hadn't changed a lick. And while they were praying, I'm saying, yep, just what I thought. Just what I thought. And then sat through my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, listened to a guy tell his story. Didn't make a speech. He told his story. I'd never heard anything like that. I mean, I'd heard alcoholics tell all kinds of stories, but not their own. You know, and that had to be true. Nobody gonna make that up. I thought, my God, this has got to be the craziest man. I really did. I thought he's some kind of fruitcake. I mean, he's dressed up in obligatory blue preaching suit. And I mean, telling stuff I wouldn't have told anybody drunk as I'd ever been. And I thought, what in the world is wrong with this guy? I had no clue. No clue whatsoever. And when he finished, he didn't finish. He later became my sponsor. I wouldn't have believed it. But he didn't finish. He just quit. And he did. I left. I was more confused than I was when I went in. The amazing thing, though, there's something about the connection in a speaker meeting. That's my favorite, I think, most important form of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's where we share with each other. We identify at a gut level, not with anecdotal stuff. We identify by being broken and healed. And that's exactly what that guy was doing. And it took me a while to understand that. And so when I came back the next week. If I hadn't, nobody would have paid any attention to it whatsoever. 300 guys in that group, they wouldn't have missed me. Wouldn't even known I was there. Nobody else would have been concerned. They didn't have any record keeping or any kind of whip snapping or anything like that. Nobody would have cared. But something brought me back. You know, I love enthusiastic people. I think they just add something. Enthusiastic people don't have to do anything. They can walk in a room and the room will change when they walk in. And fortunately, that's the guy who spoke at my first meeting, most enthusiastic fellow I'd ever seen at that time. And he absolutely lit up the room. And that's what brought me back. It wasn't understanding or desiring or looking for new life. Here was a guy who was genuinely alive and the Spirit communicated. And that's what brought me to my second meeting. I still didn't believe I was alcoholic. I was in AA for 2 years before I ever identified with a single member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I lived for a good while on just the spirit of the fellowship and the fact that it was a good, solid group. And the group I walked into truly was one. And it took me a while to figure it out. But that was a group. One thing about a group that's important to me is that there's a sensitivity in a group that's obviously not going to happen in a casual gathering. There's a center, there's a team. It's like people are together. And there's a sensitivity in a group where when you walk in, folks will instinctively know what you need. Sometimes if somebody needs to put an arm around you. Sometimes shake hands. Sometimes give you a boot in the seat. It's always just got to make the determination by what you're looking at. And since we've been there, we know what to look for. And that's what happened. Those guys, I don't know how they did it. I became one of them. Yeah, I became one of the leaders of that group. But when I walked in, I lead nothing. But they apparently picked up. Either I had a great deal of need, or some, I don't know why they picked up. Nobody ever told me. But nobody ever asked me if I wanted to get in service. Sometimes we treat service as if it's an extracurricular activity. Yeah, not so. I think Bob made it real clear that that service is fundamental to the program of recovery. And I won't get off on that too much, but I think when you get 10, 11, or 12, it's significant to me. Everything from 10 to 12 starts with me. None ends with me. It never ends with me. It always ends with turning our attention to others, because it's a self-centered condition. And if I spend my time concentrating on self, I'm going to be real slow in growth. And so that's what in that group. The guys picked on me and said, hey, guy, how about helping us out? Helping move the chairs. I'm one of the best chair setter uppers in the world. I really am. I've been doing it for 53 years. God knows. If I'm not good at it, I better quit. And I am good at it. It was great training. It's what made me feel a sense of belonging. That's why I like that thing of getting people involved, because that's what makes you feel like part of the team. And so that was as they started opening the door for me. And I had a marvelous experience in there back then. One of the things that we did, there's a rumor, but it was false, I'll tell you that, that back in the old days we used to do it better. Like Bill was talking about, there's a real contrast in how we do it now and how we did it back then. If anybody ever took anybody through anything, when I came into AA, they sure hid it well. Well, I never saw it or heard of it. Nobody did it. What folks told me, I tell you what, one of the... My God, I'm getting bald. I've got... What? One of the things that really had some significance to me, I was... I'm spending more time on this than I meant to, but it's a fascinating story. The guys and I became one of them. The leader type guys would meet with the new members and tell them, not like a beginner's meeting where you're really getting down into detail stuff, but just basically what's an alcoholic, what's anonymous, what's a sponsor, what's a group. Just introductory stuff so you'll understand the language. And I went in, been 53 years ago, and I remembered as clearly as if it were yesterday. A guy did a talk one day, and he was on the steps. We normally hang up or have sitting somewhere. In the course of it, he said, there are 200 words in these steps. And if you'll take the actions that are laid out in these steps as honestly and thoroughly as you know how to do, when you get through, you'll be a different guy. And it doesn't even matter what your motives are. And I thought, come on, man, I'm a street guy. You don't throw a curve and get a straight ball back. It doesn't work that way. And I thought, that's really kind of rinky-dink. But the boy was telling the truth, because that's exactly what I did. Nobody ever took me through a book or took me through steps, nor anybody else that I ever heard of. That what I did is fumble my way through and took them to the best of my ability. And I had an absolute transformation. Not just finding hope. I found a transformation. I became a new guy, a different guy, a guy than I had ever been, and became a free man. And I'm a maximum custody penitentiary that was like an absolutely carnivorous jungle. I became a free man. Free man. Learned to live with dignity and honor and peace and usefulness. First time in my life that I've ever done any of that. And truly a different thing. And then I was released on parole after 3.5 years. I had a 50-year max in Michigan. 1/4 of the max was the parole eligibility date. And I was released on condition to go to North Carolina and not stay in Michigan. And that seemed like punishment at the time. It's, I had to get grown up before I could appreciate my own home. So, anyway, That was the guy, and that's what led me up. And fortunately, and I was the recovery group at that penitentiary was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. By any standard, as good as any I've seen. It's really a strong, effective group. And I'll always be great. That'll always be the home group, and I'll always have cherished memories of that. It prepared me well. You know, we all have to go through transitions. Certainly going from a maximum custody penitentiary to a citizen is a huge jump. But I was well prepared. I was a solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a contact that I found and secured a year before I was able to even be considered for release. I wanted to be ready. And the good, best way to deal with transition, be solid in the program. And it's a no-brainer. And so when I hit the street, started immediately into AA, and day one, I was well prepared. I knew where I was going. The guy that met me knew where I was going. And we contacted, and I've never looked back. And I tell you, it's a good thing I was well prepared. By the first meeting I went to on the street, was honest to God, the worst group I had, the worst meeting I'd ever attended. I mean, if we'd have had one that bad in the penitentiary, somebody would have got hurt. I mean, man, we didn't do junk like that. My God, we're sitting there talking about hunting dogs. Anyway, it was just an absolute waste. And I thought, for God's sakes, is this it? Go back to jail so I can have recovery. I was 25 miles from a big city, Charlotte, our biggest city. And I thought, man, I'm going to go over there where the action is. I'm going to stay here in Mayberry. No way. Then a troubling thought occurred to me, and I warn you, if you're a relative new in the program, it'll come to you. You better be ready to duck, because the troubling thought was, when do you become responsible, big guy? When do you stand up to the plate? When do you step in and try to do what needs to be done? You know, if you want to see that elaborated on, look at the right at 164, where you end in that first that part of the book. And what it says, when you go to a town and you can't find what you're looking for, create the environment you're looking for. Well, that's exactly what it did. I didn't quote the book. I just knew that somebody needed to do something, and I was somebody. And so I stayed and had the magnificent experience of starting Alcoholics Anonymous in a city. I understand what the first 100 did. I understand that very well. I understand that about what happens when you start getting rolling in the city. And I could fascinate you with 1,000 stories about what happens in the development of a program in a city. Absolutely wonderful stuff. And so that was it. That's what put me on the road and made a road warrior out of me. And I've never looked back nor slowed down. In my 53rd year, I'm as active as I've ever been in my life. I don't mean I go to meetings. I mean I'm in the business of carrying the message wherever I am. You know, and I plan to do that. I've got, you know, if you won't tell anybody, I'll tell you something. I'm 78 years old. That's old. Well, not compared to Cliff. But it's old. You remember 78, Cliff? Yeah, barely. But that's old. I've got people telling me all the time, man, you need to slow down. Slow down, my God, man, I'm 78 years old. I don't have much time left. I gotta hurry. I ain't gotta slow down. I gotta pack it in. And so that's what I want to do. My wife votes a resounding no to that, by the way. She's 40 years in Al-Anon and thinks she's in charge of me. And but God, what a life, eh? What a life. And so that's who I am now. Yeah, I had really did have some magnificent experiences. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, like I mentioned about what Bill was saying about the contrast between now and the old days. Now, I was in the old days, and I can tell you he was absolutely right in one sense of the word. But let me contrast it a little bit. The finest, most effective work I have ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, bar none, is when I first started taking people through the book. Now, I do it in groups. I don't do it one at a time. I don't have the luxury of a whole lot of time left. I don't mean living, but I mean my week's pretty full. And so I do groups. And after having done groups, I wouldn't do it one-on-one if I had all the time in the world. because I don't want to become the mentor in perpetuity. And that's what you run the risk of doing when you do it one-on-one, that you're the only guy with the magic. So I like groups. I believe in what groups do. I don't want people to just fall in love with me. I want them to fall in love with the fact that this is a fellowship where you can thrive, where you can be a member, you know, and not somebody that needs a specialist to get his work done. And so I do it that way. Most effective work I've ever done. And the first one I did was, what my criteria for it is, if you make every session, if you make one, I just assume you drop. So, but if you're going to do it, you got to do it all. You can't just take half measures, you know. And so that, I'm pretty stringent about that. If you can't make it, don't try. Just get out the way, you know. Don't come in here and visit, you know. And so we started out. Now, the first one I had 15 people. That we had a few at the first meeting, and then some, when they saw we were really serious, kind of hid. But I had 15 that stood in there. And we went through the book. Not rocket science, but it went through the book. Had a great dinner, a little dinner conversation with somebody last night about that. Wonderful, wonderful work. And I'll just tell you about that, because it is the effectiveness of what we do now as compared to back in the old days when we didn't do anything even remotely like that. And when people, now it was a y'all come kind of thing. We didn't pick anybody. Yeah, I got guys I sponsored and said, if you want to do this thing, okay, but I'm not going to mandate it. If you want to do it, okay. If you don't, okay. Everybody did. And I said, we can bring anybody you want to. Well, we wound up with 15 people. And there was one person, there was a woman came in that I just flat didn't like. I mean, I love women. I married one. But a woman came in and I'm a fairly open-minded guy, but she's a stone atheist and proud of it. And she wanted to advertise it, you know. And she was, I thought her whole mission in AA was to argue with me. And it seemed like that's what she did. So she walked in, my heart just dropped. I said, oh God, the debate in society starts. And interesting what happens when you get into some serious work like that, eh? I watched them. She sat down with two other aggravated cases. And interesting to watch as we started to go through. I was naturally watching them to see if there's any outbreak of violence or anything. But I watched them starting to settle down and started watching them getting involved and soften up and listen. And I'm a great believer in spontaneity, provided it's well planned. Is that ludicrous or what? It's true. Well, we spontaneously ended a session one night on the third step prayer. Oh, it just happened somehow. Leader didn't have much to do with it. Only picked the page. We got to that, and I sort of knew what my strategy was. So we got through with our session, and I said, we're going to do something different tonight. We're not going to close with the Our Father. We're going to close with the third step prayer. There are three options. One, you can join hands, get out and do it with us. Or two, you can hold our hands while we do it. Or three, you can step back and watch us do it. And that lady told me a little later on, I won't tell you what she said, but I try to be clean up here as much as I can. And which is pretty good. I don't screw up much. She told me later that when I gave that little mandate to the group about how to do it, she said, well, she told me what she called me. I've never been talked about like that in a bar. I mean, I've been in barroom fights that weren't as vicious as that. And man, she broke on me, but she didn't say anything to me. And she was never the same woman. Now, she didn't have a burning bush experience. She was a gal, but she was a transformed lady. The debate was over. And she became probably the warmest, most gracious, certainly female member in my area. If anybody had told me I would do this, I'd have thought they were drinking. She became my backup if I had to be gone. I would turn it over to her. I wouldn't have even let her make a phone call before that. And she did a great job. And right today, she's one of the most sensitive, effective women in AA that I know. if I have any problem that I want to get a female to deal with, she's my go-to person. So that, if nothing else, it convinced me of the power of some of the stuff we do now, Bill, as opposed to back then. And the only thing that concerns me now is that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual experience. And if we don't watch it, we can move it into an academic exercise. And when we get to the point where we intellectualize what we're about, instead of really getting down to who we are and what is it that's turning us around, you know, we make a bad mistake. I worry sometimes about how many studies we do and all of this stuff. Now, God is not rocket science. You know, it's a simple book. You know, he wrote the thing. If you looked at the authors of the book, that was a shabby crew. I mean, man, come on. God had to be the writer of that book because there were some bad drunks. I knew some of them. Scary. Anyway, I tell you what. I want to read. I'm not going to read to you till you go to sleep because you're too hard to wake up. There's a place in the book that... I don't have my darn glasses. Oh, you got them. You got them. No wonder I don't have them. Don't you? Just, I would have trusted you to put your hand in the pocket. It'd be all right. I was watching you. Pretty kind. Great. Let me give it back to you. Yeah, there's a place in it. It's right at the end of Dr. Bob's story. Why do we call him Dr. Bob? They don't call me Warden Ivester. Anyway, we're stuck with it. In his story, he says he wrote something that I think is awfully, awfully important. And you've heard about it here this weekend. He's talking about what happened after he made that frantic phone call and he answered it. And then they set up this trap to get Dr. Bob, and then they conned him into coming to the gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate. Y'all know that story. And so when they got him in there, they're going to have a 15-minute meeting because he was a busy physician. He didn't have any patients, but he was a busy physician. And it turned into 6 hours. Here's what he said about that. And it has great meaning and impact on many areas that I am concerned of in AA. He said, that was June the 10th of 35. The question which might naturally come into your mind would be, what did the man do or say that was different from what others had done or said? You bear in mind who the characters are. It's a highly trained physician and a broken down, decrepit ex-stockbroker. And what was it? Now, what caused this broken down stockbroker to have impact on a scientifically trained man like Bob Smith? And then he answered his own question, what did he do? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone who knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking, who had had most of the drunkard's experiences known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I had been trying to employ, that is to say, the spiritual approach. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism which was undoubtedly helpful. And then the rest of this is in the squiggly language, in italics, which means, be sure to read this, of far more importance. He was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. I think that is not only profoundly stated, but profoundly valid for what we do. That's what we're about. That's why I want to be leery about getting into some educational pursuit and trying to define things into the stratosphere. You know, I want to keep it grounded and realize that what's truly important to us is how we connect. And I think that's so vital. It's not only vital to us in our personal recovery, I think it's vital in the fellowship. I'll give you one example of a way that's tremendously important to me. Y'all's fast clocks run fast out here. I sponsor a group in a prison. probably one of my most strong commitments is for obvious reasons. That's part of my heritage here. But it's not just that. I really believe developing that trust with people who quit trusting, tremendously important work. So I sponsor a group. And I was over there one night, and the guys were having an election. And it was a simple kind of election. They'd just nominate him, vote for him. And they nominated a guy named Mike, nice fella, who was the chairman of the Narcotics Anonymous group at the institution. And they started to vote, and I said, whoa, hold on, guys. Now, I don't like to correct people publicly. I mean, I do have the right to do it, but I don't like to do it. Because it's embarrassing, it's humiliating for somebody to put you down. And so I knew that. But I also know that our common welfare is more important than one guy's feelings. And so I said, I'll join you. I think that is important, by golly. I said, you can't vote. You can't elect Mike as the president. He's not an alcoholic. AA meetings are conducted by AA members, not nice people. Well, maybe nice people, but that's coincidental. It was done by AA members. And so we got somebody else and moved on. After the meeting, the chairman said to me, Tom, a lot of us are really ignorant and confused about that whole idea of singleness of purpose. Would you elaborate on that just a little bit? I said, well, not just a little bit, but I'll make a long speech about it. And so and I had never used that passage before. But I don't know, somehow I just intuitively knew that said something highly relevant. And so I got a book and said, you guys are familiar with the story, eh? And they are, about the gatehouse and what happened. Then I read that. I said, that defines singleness of purpose. It absolutely defines singleness of purpose. It's why it's important. Just having commonality about chemical makeup of stuff and saying, well, it's all the same, really is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. That's a meaningless conversation. You hear it a lot. Well, it's all the same. What difference does it make? Well, it makes a hell of a lot of difference. Hell of a lot of difference. Because it's not about education. It's about identification. Just like Bob said, when he listened to Bill tell that story, he said, I'm like that. I'm like that. Felt the first connection he'd ever felt. And that's what's fundamental. Now, I tell you, Bill, one of the things that I'm really, really keyed on and truly believe is that we are more and more moving into being a fellowship where that matters less and less. I know wide areas of this country where there is no pretense of singleness of purpose. I mean none. Where it's not even a factor. Y'all come. And that means, hey, y'all go. Because it becomes something else. And so I think a tremendously important thing. And in all honesty, I think we're losing the battle. I truly believe we're losing the battle. Because too many people are acquiescing and saying it really doesn't matter. Well, I think exactly the example of Bob tells exactly why that does matter. Also cites why singleness of purpose is important. If I tell somebody they're going to a closed meeting and you're going to be with people like you, and they walk in, the first thing they hear is some guy describing a crack trip, it's going to be a little hard to accommodate. It's going to be a little hard to identify. And so I think very much so that we've really drifted in this thing of drifting into sort of the more casual we've got, you know, the more loose we become, and the less stringent about trying to maintain the principles that are vital to the program. So I have great concerns about that kind of thing. I think of all the stuff that I'm concerned about as a member of AA, of all the things I'm concerned about, and I'm deeply grateful and proud of a lot of stuff we do, but I'm deeply troubled by stuff we do. I am deeply troubled by the proliferation of casual gatherings that they're meetings. There really is no distinction spelled out anywhere. You know, in our literature, there's nothing that distinguishes when does it quit being a meeting and become a group. There is none. You have to make that judgment. But if you look at the traditions, you look at the things that, the spiritual things that guide us, you're not going to find a rule book, but you'll find it in the principles. A group has but one primary purpose. One. That's to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's primary. That's a spiritual principle. It's not a something written in stone somewhere, but it's very much written even more than stone. And so we move more and more into those kind of lightweight little gatherings. And I tell you, I'm going to talk about this just a little bit. Well, not just a little bit. Some. I'm a guy. I am from the old days, and I experienced dealing with alcoholics when there was nowhere to take them. I mean nowhere. I held an held an alcoholic in my arms while he died one night on the 12-step call. I had nowhere to go with him. You know, if you go to the hospital, it put us both in jail. You know, that just simply wasn't done. And so I was somebody who yearned for a better way, who yearned to see a day when alcoholics could be treated with dignity and professionalism. And that day came. And God was ever grateful when we started genuinely treating it like an illness as a society. And man, I was absolutely thrilled. And I'm still grateful for it. But good news sometimes has bad news with it. And so what happened with the advent and the development of treatment in the world, we didn't deal with it well, frankly. We didn't deal with it well at all. You know, rather than recognizing that our world was changing, what we did was back off and become resentful that people were doing things that were foreign to what we did. And you started hearing people bashing treatment. Well, these guys are doing what we're doing. They're taking money for it. You know, that kind of stuff. And so we started polarizing Alcoholics Anonymous from the place where alcoholics could get into the springboard into the program. And we started backing away. We started not developing relationships. And I'm sorry to say it in a way, but a treatment center started in the little area I live in. And we have a program called CPC, Cooperative Professional Community. That goes along with public information. Vitally important things. When that treatment center came in, the management of the facility that was being built contacted me rather than us contacting them. So we were in a passive position rather than taking the initiative moving in. Two of the managers came and met with two or three of us from the fellowship. It was a vitally important meeting. We talked about our relationship, about what kind of meetings we would have, how often, who would come, about how what we would do in terms of visiting, walking around the halls. So we set out the game plan for a good program. And until that program center closed down, we never had friction one because we planned it. Cooperation with the professional community means work with, not send letters or make speeches to them. Cooperate means work with. And we didn't do that. And so we started backing away. And some things that are vitally important in Alcoholics Anonymous started to wane and sometimes disappear. And so what I'm talking about is this. I said my fundamental concern is the lack of good, strong home groups. You know, we got a pamphlet, not a pamphlet, it's a little paperback book called Home Group Heartbeat of AA. And I believe that's absolutely true. Home Group Heartbeat of AA. That's the basic tip, the place where the leadership from Alcoholics Anonymous should spring. But rather than that being the case, I think Cliff said it, unfortunately, said it very well last night. Talking about his city with over 600 meetings of various sorts, and when we come together to handle the things of concern in our fellowship, 40 groups are represented. That's not just sad, that's a travesty. It's a travesty. And so it's why I have great concern about that. Because where does that leave us as a fellowship? When the people who supposedly, you know, the thing that happened in 55 in St. Louis, when Bill, in effect, Bob was gone, and when Bill effectively introduced the General Service Conference and the structure of the three legacies, and then turned the fellowship over to the membership, built on the notion that the home group would be the driving force, that the General Service representative would take the conscience of the group and it would take it to the conference, and there would be the leadership of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, when you have 40 out of 600, you barely have a minority opinion. Barely. I'm not even sure it would constitute a minority. It's too skinny. I wish I could say that's a peculiar thing of San Diego. It is not. It is not. I've looked at this just a little bit. Well, no, I haven't. I've looked at it a whole lot. And the numbers are a little... He only got about 4% in San Diego, maybe 5 at best. In my state, and I'll bet yours too, it's 23% in my entire state. In the entire United States, I talked with the chairman of the Board of Trustees, and I said... We were doing a workshop together, and I said, "I sure hope you have a different view of things than I do." But I'm troubled by some stuff. And I said, "Let me tell you my view, and then I want to hear yours." And so I told him exactly what I'm saying to you. Not as long, but I told him what my view was, and the 23%. And he kind of looked sad. He was a non-alcoholic trustee, but he was a fine man. And he said, "I wish I could tell you that my view was different. But I can't. It's exactly the same." Well, that's us, folk. That's not some foreign entity. That's us. That's our fellowship. And that's why I think it's so important to recognize those places where we've got frailties in the program, where we need to strengthen. How do we do it? How do we rise to the challenge of doing that stuff? So some stuff happened. Part of that thing, get back to that treatment thing, part, and the impact it had on us, is everywhere you see a treatment center develop, AA meetings would double almost overnight. And so what you had were little gatherings that were much like aftercare groups. Much like aftercare groups. And basically, how was your day? You know, how's it going? You know, this kind of thing. If that's the depth you get into in AA, you're going to have an awfully shallow program, eh? Awfully shallow. And so that was one of the products of that thing. The other thing was that, and I really appreciated what Cliff was saying about the about some sponsorship. If you want to evaluate the weight and value of sponsorship, listen to what he said about Bill. Not this Bill, oh, the old Bill. The one who 12-stepped him. When he's talking about that last night, 40 years later, he can't do it without excuse me, without tearing up. Means that much. Because once you get to gain the trust of an alcoholic, you got it for a lifetime, unless you violate it. And that's something very important about this. Something very important about that whole business of 12-step. And if as you start to see what was happening when that was coming along with that deterioration of home groups and the multiplication of just casual gatherings, that pretty soon became characteristic of the fellowship, is who we are. And that's deeply troubling to me. I hope it is to you. If it isn't, I hope you will take a hard look at that. Evaluate it in your community. Evaluate it in your group. And see where you are on this thing of looking after the welfare of the program that saved our lives, because we got some folks behind us. I want to be sure it's available to them. So it had enormous impact on that. And that home group is the heartbeat of AA. The other thing that happened in there that was that 12-step calls, probably the most priceless experience. You've heard that expressed here several times. And I would add to it. You know, that 12-step calls are probably the most valuable experience that you can have in working with alcoholics. When you can earn that trust of an alcoholic, and it is absolutely, you can't buy it. It's just something you earn, and it goes with it. And I swear, you know, I had 3 12-step calls last year. All of them came from ministers as a result of CPC. And I've had 3 at one time, for God's sakes. You know, if you tried to get 3 brand new drunks in a car and keep peace, you know, I'd put the one with 30 minutes sober over the one that was still drunk and say, you hold him down there. But what a difference, eh? But now, yeah, I have 3 in one year. And and I think that bears looking at, you know, that because such a vital experience. It just has when you do a 12-step call, just like Cliff demonstrated, it builds a loyalty that is unquestionable. Unquestionable. And the person that you call on would not hesitate 10 seconds from doing the same thing for somebody else. And today it's almost a lost art. Now this is a far above average gathering. Because you've been willing to come to Prim Valley. Woo! Prim Valley. And spend good money. Now you could be out there sinning somewhere, gambling like a stuff. But because here we've gathered. So this is a special gathering. And you got to be a little above just entry level, unless somebody drug you at your now. But you got to be a little above entry level. And I would just take a wild guess that 75 to 80% of this group has never experienced a 12-step call as provider or consumer. It's almost a lost experience at Alcoholics Anonymous. And most people now, when they come into Alcoholics Anonymous, is because of some kind of social references or whatever. You know, I don't mean pedigree references, but, you know, you've been captured by somebody or whatever, or referred by somebody. But that thing of linking to another alcoholic, you know, when people walk in out of a social referral, they sort of sit over there and we try to make them feel like they're at home. Well, it's a far cry from what happens on a 12-step call. And those things are extremely rare now. They're very rare. And the overwhelming majority of our fellowship has no experience whatsoever in it. Vital thing. But it's a product of that. You know, as treatment centers emerged, why did you need to make 12-step calls? My God, we got both bus loads of new people being parked in the parking lot. You didn't have to hunt drunks. You know, a friend of mine started a group in a little old town. He called me one night and he said, Tom, we got a real problem. Yeah, we need a little guidance on us. What is it? He said, well, we started a new group. And I said, well, that's great. And he said, well, we were a real small group. And he said, the other night, a bus pulled up and had 41 people on it. And I said, my God, man, your prayers are answered. You got a lot of people. He said, we got no coffee, and we got no money, and we got 41 people. And he said, what do you do? Isn't that an interesting problem, eh? They were overwhelmed with new drugs coming in. And so anyway, it just created an awful lot of interesting twists of that we have to deal with and very troubling things. And so 12-step calls quit happening. They just quit happening. Oh, you've got to dribble like I've done. But they used to characterize the fellowship. They're almost unheard of now. We don't know how to do. I was in a meeting. Good God, I'm hurt quick. Won't sound like it. But I'm going to hurry. I sat in a meeting one night. I was speaking to a group. And a drunk woman came in the back door. And she was, now, I think drunk women are kind of exciting. They're going to do something. I guarantee you, they're going to do something. They don't ever come in quietly, you know. So she came in, and she's singing very poorly. But she was singing vigorously. So I'm enjoying it. You know, I'm like the psychiatrist in the burlesque show. I'm watching the audience. And so she's back there creating her calamity. And now, it didn't bother me. I thought it livened up the meeting. But it was interesting to watch the group. Because what you saw was this sort of looking at each other nonverbal of somebody need to do something, call 911. You know, nobody knew what to do. And then finally, an old gal, well, I don't send this to North Carolina Lee, a lady, a refined young lady, saying, she just slowly got up and did what you do if you know what to do. If you don't know what to do, you sit there, look around. Somebody do something. Yeah. She got up, went up back there, the gal gone back in the kitchen. That's very unladylike, banging pots and stuff. She went back there, put her arm around her, took her to another room, did what you do, for God's sakes, if you know what to do. And so that's where we are. That's where we are. And it's what concerns me, you know, that we do have some real things that we're deficit in the program today. We got tons of meetings. But when it comes to well-ordered, purposeful groups that practice the legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to look long and hard to find them. You've got to look long and hard. If you've got one, thank God. If you don't, for God's sake, start one. I won't be nearly finished. I'm just barely started. But I'm going to quit anyway because y'all going to leave and I want to go with you. And I'll give you one example, just how simple it can be. But I was talking to the lady last night about this. That big book thing I was saying, the first one I did, and we had the 15 people finish. Yeah, when people finish an experience like that, they're pumped. And so when we got through with that, everybody went wondering. Most of they weren't all from my group. They were scattered around in that area. And so they started coming to me and saying, Tom, we need to start a group. I said, well, fine, you're ready for it, go do it. So, no, you're kind of our leader. We want you to go with us. I said, I can't go with you, for God's sakes. I'm the founder of the group I'm in. They said, well, but we need you, though. I said, well, tell me what you want to do. And said, well, we got all excited about what we're doing in Big Book Workshop, and we've got no real vehicle for the energy. Yeah, we don't know what to do with it. And said, we want to get a group where there'll be action. Well, they caught my attention when they said that. I said, now, I'll tell you what. If you really want to get into action, I'm with you. If you want to start a meeting, good luck, because they ain't going. And they said, no, we want action. And I mean lots of it. And so I'll give you this as quickly as I can, but I'm from North Carolina. We don't talk fast. We don't even think fast. And what we did, we didn't just start a meeting to see what will happen. As so often, we'll see what happens. You know, no, we did. We planned what would happen. We had 10 people that wanted to be in on the formation of the group. Met in the back of a guy's place of business. And now, I'm a brainstorming guy. I really believe. No, I don't believe it. I know it. My first thought is always my best one. And if I go reconsider it, I'll screw it up. But my first thought is usually as good as it gets. And so I like brainstorming because it's quick. You don't get into laborious meetings that last a month. You know, you get on with business. And so I like that. So I led the deal. They since I'm the leader, I'm supposed to lead the deal. So I said, all right, we're going to brainstorm. All I want you to do is name one component or activity or quality that you would insist on having in this group. And said, if you name it, we'll put it on the board. Don't explain it. Don't discuss it. Put it on the board. In 12 minutes, we listed 19 things that people would insist on having. We would probably come up with a similar list if we did that right here. Because they're just the age-old things of this thing, of that, what we wanted the ingredients to be of a group. Well, when we got through with that, starting the group, developing the group, was a no-brainer. All we had to do is look at what people want and then look at how do you get that done. And so what we wound up was the group. We call it Primary Purpose. That's not just a catchy name. We're not a franchise, by the way. We are a group. We took Primary Purpose because that's our job. That's what we want to do. Our primary purpose is to carry the message that alcoholics still suffer. That's what we wanted to do. So we went to work. And we named, if you look at an old, Lee's already got the thing up there. Is he ready to put it on? We started just naming offices, you know, naming ways we would do it. If there is a service in Alcoholics Anonymous that exists at general service level or state level or anyway, it's in our group, not only in name, but staffed and functional, every one of them. Treatment, CPC, PI, corrections, it's there. We have a committee that's structured to carry out that commitment. All of our committees are autonomous bodies. They need no permission from the larger group to do anything unless they need money. Then they'll come get it out of kitty. No, they'll come get it from treasury. And so we're off and running, eh? We had the design, we had the structure, we had it. By the way, if you ever want to see that, there's an example of that in the Third Legacy Manual. I don't know if it's a current one, but there's two or three back. I know it's in there. And I thought it was original. But we're off and running. So we knew what we were going to do. The first meeting, we had 41 people at the first meeting, never had made an announcement anywhere. Word gets out in a small town. And so folks came. One of the committees we had was a newcomer group. And I want to tell you about this one because it served a mutual purpose. We had a chairman, a newcomer committee, and after we'd met two or three times, I guess, he came to me one night and said, "Tom, we ain't got no newcomers." I said, "Yeah, you know, I've noticed that." And he said, "What do you think we ought to do?" I said, "Well, start a newcomers group." And he said, "Didn't you hear what I said? We ain't got no newcomers." I said, "Yeah, I heard that." I said, "You ever heard of Marmaduke?" And he said, "Who?" I said, "Never mind. If you build it, they'll come." And we started a newcomer group. The first night, we had 20-some people sitting in the newcomers group. And it's never been less than that very often. It's been a tremendous, tremendous asset. Great way to introduce new people. We encourage people with less than 6 months to attend. We absolutely defy anybody with over six months to attend. Many times, newcomer groups get ruined by old-timers flooding it. And the newcomers become an afterthought. And so we want to do that. I've never been. 14 years, I've never attended a newcomer meeting. I say, if you need me, call me. Otherwise, I'm going to trust you. You go for it. And so it's great. It also solves singles of purpose problems. We've had, in 14 years, we've had one problem, which we handle very quietly with no problem. That newcomer meeting is an absolute diversion for people who don't know where to go. And so our group is equipped to help them to understand where to go, help them to make contact. A valuable, vital tool in a group. Probably one of the most important things there. I get tired when I talk that bad. And so, anyway, I guess to just kind of wrap up, you know, I'm not going to give you any homework, but I tell you, if you want to do something, if you're in one of those pockets of leisure living, and you want to really stir up some action, you don't need to form some big organization or something. Go back to your town or community or farm or whatever it is and take a look around at where alcoholics are hitting the wall. And they're hitting the wall in every town every day. And now, increasingly, treatment is less and less available. We may be back to the good old days, Bill. We may be back to the good old days. We're headed that way. Now, I don't like that, but if you want to do something, find out where alcoholics are hitting the wall, and when they come off, they stand there bewildered, and whoever's watching them is bewildered as well about what to do. If they've got plenty of money or insurance, they go to treatment, but more and more people don't, and they stand there bewildered. Take a look at that. Take a look at it in your community, and visualize what needs to be done. Didn't do it. And you help write. You and I are writing the next edition of the book right now. And I'd like to see us write that book in scarlet letters so that it is really moving on. Folks, good to see you. Thanks. Thanks a million.